This is Car Expert.
And you get 700 newton meters. If you're driving the kids to school and you're in a hurry, you can just lean on it and it just buggers off, for want of a better term.
I have always said that European Ford product is actually fundamentally excellent, but just no one buys them.
For Isuzu, it couldn't be coming at a better time for the brand. So I think this is going to be one of the biggest launches of the year.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. G'day, Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy Turner. How are you?
Oh, great. Hello, James Wong.
Hello, hello. How are we all?
Oh, that great. We had a bit of sarcasm in it because welcome to lockdown number 4 in Melbourne. Or
yes,
Victoria,
we are.
I should say.
I'm sorry for all of our non-Victorian listeners, and analytics tell us that that is the majority of you, but yes, we are currently a bit raw because we've just learned that we're going to face another one-week lockdown. So I think we're all feeling a little bit grim at the prospect at the moment. I was actually supposed to be heading up to Sydney this evening to work in the Car Expert Experience Centre this weekend, as was Scott. Obviously, that has been kiboshed.
Yes.
Luckily, we've got staff in other states to cover it. But it's a very small sacrifice on my part, but it is a bit grim to be going back into this again, isn't it?
You know what? It makes it even worse for me. I know it can fall on any day, but tomorrow is my birthday, and that's day one of lockdown.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Had planned to go to Adelaide to see my best friend. I was supposed to be on a plane right now, as you said, Moko. Great times to be
now
alive.
Now you're going to have one of those lovely Zoom conversations FaceTime conversations.
It's so not the same.
You can just make up for it next week. We'll be right.
Exactly.
Actually, speaking of the Experience Centre, I was up there for a whole week last week, and I had a really good time speaking to a lot of new people that I met, but also some return customers that I met the first time I was up there. It was actually quite interesting to see, yeah. And a lot of people asking questions about different kinds of vehicles. So I had a lot of people asking about plug-in hybrids and EVs this time around, which was quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And we've also got added an MG ZST to the floor up there, which seems to be grabbing a lot of people's attention because it's in this lovely ruby red and it's quite an attractive car. And people want to find out more about it. So I had a good time. It's always just for me so interesting to actually meet real car buyers and find out what they're interested in, what their priorities are, and see how diverse buyer needs are in this market. So it's great.
The returning people, were they people who have already bought a car and have come back to say thank you, or they're still undecided? Or
It was actually kind of a mix. We had one family come in who had bought, I think, Hyundai Palisade after speaking to Paul. There were a couple of people that had either just put an order down on a Renault Captur or were just coming back with their partner to confirm that they wanted to buy the Captur. I had another lady come in who trialed basically every compact SUV that we had on the floor and then ended up wanting to look at one that we didn't have on the floor. She was really interested in the Peugeot 2008 after driving the 3008 and really enjoying it. So it was, really interesting. So it's good to see that, people actually coming in and saying that we've helped them, beyond tooting our own horn or anything like that. It's just nice to know that you're helping people, because that's one thing that I love about this job is that, I like to be the helper in like friendship groups or within my family. And so to sort of be able to do that in a way that helps other people with something that's, for a lot of people, a car purchase is really important, because even if you don't care about cars, it's probably the second biggest purchase you're ever going to make. It's something that you're going to be likely driving around every day. And so, it's a little bit of me that I can give to people in my everyday work.
A little bit of JWO doesn't hurt. All right, we'll get stuck into this week's show. All right, let's cover off on some of the biggest news items of the week, the 2021 MG ZST. We've got the details for this, and it's arriving in June, JWO.
Yeah, so we touched on this very briefly at the beginning of the podcast because obviously it's a popular car. We're seeing a lot of them on the roads. People are coming into the Experience Centre and asking a lot of questions about the one we have there. And I think it's gotten so popular that MG wants to bring in two new variants. So at the moment, the range starts at about $29,990 drive away. So these two new variants are actually going to slot under the existing ones and start from a little over $25,000 drive away, which when you consider the amount of features that even the base car has, has, as well as the size of the MG ZST, because it's a little bit bigger than, say, your CX-3. It actually seems like really, really good value. So they're going to bring the ZST Core and the ZST Vibe. You can actually order them now, and they're going to start arriving in June. And even from this base car, which is $25,490 drive away, you get things like 17-inch alloy wheels, a 10.1-inch color touchscreen with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, 360-degree cameras, LED headlights and tail lights, and the full MG Pilot safety suite. So that gets you things like autonomous emergency braking, adaptive cruise control, lane keep assist. You also get keyless entry and push button start. So all the kind of features that you might expect from a more expensive vehicle. And, you know, even it's still got alloys, it's got nice lights and things like that. I feel like they are going to make a killing on these things. And given it seems like the Chinese brands haven't been as adversely affected by supply chain interruptions as some of the other brands, I think that there'll be plenty of them to go around. And I think that given I've seen so many ZSTs in Melbourne and in Sydney, it seems like people really like the look of them. They like the, how they drive. It seems like we might start to see even more of them on the roads.
Yeah. I think people are starting to realize that they're good value for money. Like a lot of all that, those features you just mentioned.
Yeah,
sometimes
for sure.
Don't come standard, or you have to option them. So
yeah. Plus you're covered by a 7-year warranty.
Yeah.
If you told the average, you know, car industry follower 2 years ago that MG would be in the top 10 car brands for 3 months in succession, no one would believe you. And then, you know, you see LDV, which is its ute company, killing it. Havel, Great Wall, or GWM, I should say. Sales growing at a rate of knots. One of the big themes in automotive at the moment is the growth of the Chinese manufacturers. And they're no longer just bought because of price, although they principally are bought because of price, but they also look pretty good and they actually are pretty good now. The gulf between them and the Japanese and Korean products has never been narrower.
Now, this is quite interesting, Moko. Look out Elon Musk and Tesla. General Motors will be launching into space soon.
Yes. So aerospace giant Lockheed Martin and little old General Motors are teaming up to develop next generation lunar vehicles, which are going to be battery powered and autonomous. So NASA, it's yet to give the companies a contract for the next lunar terrain vehicle, but it hasn't stopped GM from talking about the fact that it's working towards making one. We all know that Elon Musk's SpaceX has been contracted to build the next lunar lander for the Artemis mission, but moving forward, General Motors also wants to get involved. And I think when you look at, you know, obviously it's cool publicity. You know, clearly Elon has made car brands' aspirations to go to space a thing, and General Motors obviously wants to do a bit of that. There's a bit of, you know, stock inflating and all this, I would imagine. But also when you think about the kind of things that you need to do as a car brand in terms of developing reliable machinery, good quality autonomy, you know, things that can stand up to all sorts of abuse, sending a machine into space is a pretty good way to do that. Audi also, you know, flirted with the notion of a lunar lander a couple of years ago too. So it's half publicity stunt and half, you know, product development shortcut, I would say, and a really nice way for you to market your electric vehicles moving forward. An electric lunar lander, what's not to like? I have to say also, actually, on a side note, it is great to see big American companies being super ambitious again. You know, like the whole thing about the way America used to function was it wanted to, you know, shamelessly dominate and shamelessly lead the world in innovation. And we had this period of the big three from Detroit kind of withering on the vine. And now we're seeing, you know, GM and Ford in particular really grabbing the bull by the horns and doing that kind of thing again. So I think in a more, it's nice to see GM being so ambitious, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We touched on this one last week, the 2022 Isuzu MU-X. Well, orders will be opening soon, and no doubt, JWo, this is going to be a pretty popular car.
Yeah, so we don't know too much about what actually will make it here in terms of spec, but we do reckon that this thing is going to be very popular. So the Isuzu MU-X has been a very, very successful vehicle for the Isuzu Ute brand. It consistently sells, I think, in the top three of the large SUV segment, despite being one of only two models in a two-model range. And so this next-generation vehicle can't come soon enough because the old one is getting a little bit long in the tooth in terms of the tech and all that kind of stuff. So we already know that it basically is a wagon-bodied version of the D-Max Ute, which we have rated quite highly. And so this week they will I start to open the order books, and the first 1,500 people to pre-order them will get a unique Casio G-Shock watch. So I know there's a couple of watch aficionados at Car Expert, so I wonder if we'll see any Isuzu MUXs joining our fleet anytime soon. We don't know anything about pricing or anything like that, but it should be coming around September. So they revealed it maybe third quarter last year and said it would be 12 months from then. So using very quick math, it should be September, October. And yeah, so it'll be a major technology update. So to refresh our memory, it'll have the latest version of Isuzu's 3-liter four cylinder diesel, which has 140 kilowatts of power, 450 newton meters of torque. The outputs don't sound super flash, but when you consider that it's related to their truck engine, which is widely known as bulletproof, that's a draw card in itself. It'll be a massive tech update. We'll see all the latest driver assistance systems that you get in the D-Max Ute. So you get things like adaptive cruise control, autonomous emergency braking, lane centering. These are all things that haven't been available on the current outgoing model, which has been on sale for a little bit and continues to be quite popular. So it means that the car will be a lot safer for the next lot of buyers. And it will go up against this other established ute-based SUVs like the Ford Everest, the Mitsubishi Pajero Sport, that vein of SUV. So really excited to see this come in, because I think that given how popular the current one is and how old that is, people who maybe want something a little bit more modern and, you know, luxurious compared to the current one can now stay within the brand and keep that, you know, go anywhere hardcore rugged durability focused thing with this new MUX. So really excited to see this come here. It'll be interesting to see how they price it, to be honest. That's really the main thing.
Yeah, I mean, Isuzu has form pricing sort of between your Mitsubishi at the base level and then probably your Ford Everest at the upper level. It'll sit somewhere in that happy space. And yeah, I mean, the outgoing one continues to sell sometimes more than 1,000 units a month, because at the end of the day, it's nothing flash, but it's reliable and it's tough and it can tow 3 tons and seat 7. So for some people, that's all they want. And this car is a great update on that. I guess in a more industry-wide sense, sales of these 7-seat diesel caravan-friendly 4x4s are absolutely through the roof at the moment. We can't go overseas because of COVID. So everybody's buying their great Australian getaway vehicle. Caravan sales are up fivefold. And, you know, these big 4x4s are a similar story. So this vehicle lobbing for Isuzu, they will not be able to get their hands on enough stock of this car. They will have a waiting list. I practically guarantee it. We've seen it with the D-Max and we'll see it again with the Mux. But couldn't be coming at a better time for the brand. So I think this is going to be one of the biggest launches of the year.
Lastly, Moko, Tritium, an Australian company in Brisbane, actually, is going to be listed on NASDAQ. What is Tritium?
Yeah, so Tritium, I actually interviewed the CEO of Tritium for a feature last year. Her name's Jane Hunter. She was the ex-head of Boeing's Skunkworks division. So Tritium is a 20-year-old company based out of Brisbane that also has offices in the US and in Europe. And it's one of the world's preeminent producers of DC electric car fast chargers. So it's very interesting that Australia is widely known as a bit of a backwater for EV sales. But when it comes to EV chargers, we're actually right at the front of the world. The Ionity network that's throughout Europe that is funded by many of the major car brands actually uses Tritium componentry. So it gives you an idea of just how far spread that company has come. Now, part of the scaling process for it to take on 3 fully-fledged international R&D centers is to get some capital raising happening. And it's done that by teaming up with a special purpose acquisition company, which is basically a holding company created purely for the purpose of an initial public offering or IPO, to do that IPO with a valuation of about $1.5 billion, which using the terminology that's thrown around in tech stocks, that makes it a unicorn, which I think is a fun terminology. But any tech company that's got a valuation north of $1 billion is colloquially known as a unicorn. Now, this is not being listed on the ASX, it's being listed on the NASDAQ, which shows the company's international aspirations. Obviously, the US, China, and Europe are the big opportunities for EV chargers. But the good news is the company has pledged to also uprate and expand and improve its Brisbane facility, which is where it all began in 2001. So this is a fantastic story of a little Australian company that started, you know, 20 years ago, now hires hundreds of people, has a footprint in 41 countries, makes charges all over the globe, and he's going to be on the NASDAQ. I think when you talk about the ingenuity of Australians, when you talk about what this little country can do, we can't make stuff cheap, but we've got a lot of good education here. We've got great universities. Yeah. We've got, you know, great experience in engineering. We can make high-cost items, tertiary items, pretty well here. There's no reason why Australia can't be a world leader in tech, and this is a really good example of that. So I'll certainly be buying some shares because I think this is an incredibly exciting company, and I think it's brilliant news for the industry more widely.
20 years ago, you said it started, Marco. Were they doing EV chargers back then?
No, they were doing solar challenge race cars. I imagine the founders were just sort of engineers who just graduated uni, essentially. But then they also did cool stuff like the battery management system for James Cameron's Deep Sea Challenger submersible submarine, which I'm pretty sure went to the bottom of the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest part of the ocean that we know of. So I guess it's a company that's done some pretty interesting things, but it pivoted to making DC chargers up to 350 kilowatts because, I mean, if you're in that industry, you could see the way the writing on the wall was heading. 20% compound annual growth expected for the worldwide EV market out to 2040. I mean, why wouldn't you get involved? And the company's now proven to be among the very best in the world at what it does.
Congratulations, Tritium. Incredible stuff. Head to carexpert.com.au, click the news link. There's plenty more there for you to read through. We're going to start calling Scott Colley Mr. Audi soon. Hello, Scully.
Hello, Mandy. I've got a long way to go before I'm Mr. Audi, given how many Crawford drove last year, but I'm getting there.
Actually, yeah, that's very, very true. Last week we had you on for the Q2 and the SQ2, but we've got you on for the SQ5 this week. So let's pretend I'm a visitor to the Car Expert Experience Centre and I want to know all about what an SQ5 is. So enlighten me.
So the SQ5 is quite a unique car, actually. Audi's had this car for a little while and it's a mid-sized SUV that is a performance car. It's got the S badge on the back, so it, you know, it's faster than the normal one. It looks a bit sportier than the normal one. But finally, for 2021, again, it's also got a diesel engine. That's always been one of the big selling points with the SQ5. The first car launched, and it's got a bit of a cult following, actually, because it's got this beautiful 3-litre turbocharged 6, and it's just effortless and comfortable and torquey. And for the second generation, Audi made it a petrol on the back of Dieselgate, and then the diesel came back as a limited edition, and now finally it's the full deal again. So, yeah, it's a big deal, I think, for Audi because it's their unique selling point in the performance sort of segment there. It has always been that diesel SQ5. And I think it's finally got it back. It's finally specced it up to the point it wants it and it's ready to let it loose again.
Yeah, fantastic. What sort of price range are we looking at with this?
So pricing is just under $105,000 before on-road costs, which doesn't sound all that expensive. But when you consider what you get for your money, it's actually pretty good. It's 15 grand more than you pay for the 50 TDI, which is the previous Q5 diesel flagship. But to get a performance BMW X3, you're looking at $113,900 before on roads. The Merc GLC 43 kicks off at $120,600. And then the Polestar XC60TH plug-in hybrid is $100,600 before on roads. So I think when you look at the Audi, it doesn't seem all that much less expensive than those cars, but it is like a cheaper starting price. And when you look at everything that's standard, both of the cars that we tested had list prices of $110,000. Pretty much everything comes standard, down to metallic paint, the big wheels, Nappa leather inside. You even get the crossbars for your roof racks, which I didn't know, but apparently every Audi Q5 has always had. So on paper, just like the SQ2 we were talking about, the SQ5 is actually a bit of a bargain and it's a charming thing to drive as well, which we'll get to.
Scott, you've mentioned now already a couple of times the fact that it's come back as a diesel and obviously, the original was a diesel, but the Volkswagen Group as a whole, including Audi, went through a bit of strife not too many years ago with its diesel engines. And, you know, we've seen the market move away from diesel and certain brands commit to petrol-only and electrified engines. Why is Audi sticking with diesel power? And do you think that there's still a place for engines like this, you know, now and also the short-term future, maybe looking 5 years ahead?
So I suppose there's a few different answers there, JWO, but the main one is, yes, there is still a place for diesel. I think that people are very quick to write it off, but when you drive a nice diesel engine, and I don't mean like a little 2-litre that's been cranked up to a million PSI and is running like crazy just to make decent power numbers, but a big, relaxed, big displacement engine that, you know, has some guts to it, and the Volkswagen Group does them better than most, you realize that there is really a benefit to, you know, going for diesel instead of petrol. The engine in this one is actually quite unique. So it's very closely related to the engine that was in the pre-update, the SQ5 TDI limited edition that we got in Australia. Mm-hmm. But it's got a smaller turbocharger that's meant to spool up faster. It's got a more sophisticated exhaust treatment system to cut NOx levels. And it's actually also got a different AdBlue tank. So essentially Audi says this is cleaner than the last one. It's cleaner than the equivalent petrol engine Audi argues as well. But it also is more responsive to drive on the go. As for why people have been moving away from them, I can kind of understand on the back of Dieselgate why that's the case, because diesel got a lot of bad press and we've seen huge amounts of advancement in petrol engines as well. There used to be the case that if you wanted to go a long way with very little fuel, you had to get a diesel, but with, you know, crazy sophisticated cylinder shutdown, small turbo petrol engines running crazy air fuel ratios and that sort of thing, all of a sudden the gap has been narrowed as well. So it's not so much a black and white, I want performance or I want fuel economy, and petrol can kind of do both. So I can understand why people are moving away. I think Audi's brought this back because there is demand for a diesel in this car. I know a lot of SQ5 owners, I say a lot, I know about three, but they all really like their first generation cars and they wouldn't buy the second gen car because it wasn't a diesel again. Audi actually said that at its peak sales in Australia, the SQ5 diesel accounted for close to a third of all Q5 sales. The petrol was still a strong seller, but it never got to those heights. So it wouldn't surprise me if Audi's been pushing and pushing and pushing to get this engine and it's finally been able to, because this is the one that people really, really want in Australia.
Just to clarify, because I asked that question doesn't mean I don't agree with you, because I'm actually in the same boat where, especially for cars that size, I feel like you're never going to get the balance of performance and efficiency the same way that you do in a modern six-cylinder diesel. Those European ones are so good and they're quite proven to be fairly reliable as well from what I know. So it's so good to see that certain companies like Audi are sticking with it, because over in Europe, the S4, S5, S6 and S7, I think all come with that same engine as an option as opposed to the six-cylinder petrols that we get here. So clearly there's a way to go. And if, you know, if we're talking about reducing emissions, if they can get it cleaner than a petrol, there shouldn't be a question about it, really.
I totally agree. And I think when you drive this SQ5, I mean, you sort of, for one, it doesn't sound like a diesel from the outside, which helps. I think people, when you walk past them, you hear the sort of fake V8 noise that external speakers make. I think that helps. But I think people just need to experience it to actually understand that this doesn't really feel like an old diesel or a clattery, yucky tractor engine. It's just as smooth and just as quiet as a petrol. But for most of the driving you do, it's actually more practical because all of the torque is available just like essentially straight off idle. I think peak torque comes in at 1750 RPM and you get 700 Newton meters and it hangs around pretty much all the way through the rev range. So if you're driving the kids to school and you're in a hurry, you can just lean on it and it just buggers off, for want of a better term. And if you're in a real hurry and you're on the highway and you want to overtake, you can put your foot down and the 8-speed auto is so clever. It drops a couple of gears and you're in the meat of the torque band. And it revs out quite smoothly for a diesel as well, so you never feel like you're missing out. I think also, like in a smaller car, like a hot hatch or even an RS4 or an RS6, you really want that constant feeling of sort of straining at the leash that you get from a really powerful petrol, where you've got to really work it to get more out of it. But in an SUV like the SQ5, I would argue the more relaxed character kind of suits it. It really just feels like a car that's perfectly sort of set up for what it needs to do. It's perfectly fit for purpose because it does have a beautiful, relaxed character on the highway that makes it a really, really good car for heading to the snow or really long trips, which kind of feels like what an SQ5 owner would do.
What are the driving modes like?
So we had a fairly limited stint behind the wheel, unfortunately. It was all on the highway. The car that we drove had standard passive steel springs but active dampers. You can also option it with adaptive air suspension. In comfort mode, it's really comfortable, which I know sounds kind of obvious but isn't always the case in these cars on big wheels. It just soaks up the highway really nicely. It still feels quite taut, so it feels like it's a bit sporty, but it's also not going to shake your feelings loose. And again, you could happily spend hours behind the wheel. Flicking it into sport makes it drop down a gear. It also makes the throttle a bit touchier and firms up the ride slightly. It doesn't make a huge difference in highway conditions. I don't know why you would put it in sport on the highway, but there is definitely a noticeable change between comfort and sport when you are, you know, driving properly. The few bends we've got to throw it through, you would want it in sport just for that extra sense of weight in the steering and the sense that there's a bit more stiffness underneath you. But pretty much every drive mode you're in, from Eco, which I don't know why you'd ever touch, to comfort, to sport, the car still has that feeling of being really well controlled and really refined.
Let's get to the interior, because Audi do interiors rather well. Joe, I know you're a fan of quilted leather seats. Does the SQ5 have them as well?
The SQ5 does have quilted leather seats. They are standard and they are trimmed in Nappa leather, which is some of the nicest stuff that Audi's got in its kit. James is making happy faces there on our little... there's all sorts of stuff that used to be optional that's now standard. And Audi's done this across the Q5 range, but it's most prominent on the SQ5. So you get Nappa leather, a 14-speaker Bang & Olufsen sound system, acoustic window trim, powered steering column, all that stuff that you used to have to pay more for, that really makes this feel a bit more premium than an X3, M40, or a Polestar. The interior itself has always been a good thing in the Q5, and not much of that's changed with the update. So you still get that really snappy touchscreen. I personally miss the rotary controller, but this system is the best touchscreen you can get, I think. The icons are all massive and they click when you actually touch them. So there's less eyes off the road time than you get in some other cars, and you still get proper little metal knurled dials for the climate control, which is a win compared to the touchscreen in some other cars. It's also got a decent amount of space. Up front is really comfortable for even lanky people like me. And the back seats will hold, you know, taller adults or taller teenagers. If it's outright practicality you're after, the X3 is a better bet. It's got a bit more headroom and a bit of a boxier shape. But compared to a Porsche Macan or even a GLC, in my experience, the Q5 is arguably a little bit better off.
Was there anything that you didn't quite like about the SQ5?
I was actually kind of hard-pressed to find problems with this car. I really, really enjoyed my limited time in it, and I've really enjoyed time in previous SQ5s as well. I do think that the rear seat space being good but not great is a little bit of a problem. These are cars that people want to buy and drive every day and use them as family cars and that sort of thing. And although it is practical, I think that, you know, Audi just couldn't make the car bigger in a midlife facelift, but that does let it down slightly compared to an X3 or even an XC60. I also think there's a couple of little things that Audi's done that are a little bit kind of naff. I don't love the external speakers. They're kind of a cool idea, but if you really need to shout that loudly about the fact your diesel car makes a good noise, then put a proper exhaust on it. Don't put a little Bose speaker behind the exhaust pipes. and Audi offers on this car, and this isn't so much a criticism as an option you should avoid, but OLED tail lights. And they can change their shape based on the drive mode you're in. So if you're in normal mode, they give you a certain look, and then you flick to sport, and the shape of the elements inside the light actually change. I don't know why anyone would ever bother paying for them. Because if you've got a cop who knows what they're talking about, they'll know you're in sport mode when they pull you over. These tail lights give it away. But more than that, I just think it's sort of tech for tech's sake. And the rest of this car is so well thought out and just like solid in what it does. You just don't need to bother. You don't need to worry about adding all that extra stuff because the core product is so good. I don't really care about your OLED tail lights, to be honest.
No, see, that sounds really cool to me because it's like having a transformer. You change the mode and then it gets angry eyes at the back. That sounds sick.
Just remember, transformers aren't for Christmas. They're for life. And by, you know, five years into ownership, Mark Wahlberg will take over your tail lights and it'll just be a mess.
How's that for a tangent?
All right. That review is live at carexpert.com.au. We thank you, Scott Colley.
Thanks, guys.
Plenty of comparisons coming up on the site very soon, Moco, including your Ford Everest and Toyota Prado comparison. Wow. Talk about two caravan towers going head to head. This is going to be a popular one.
Yeah, well, we touched on that in the MUX part of the news before, didn't we? Our demand for these sorts of vehicles are at their highest ever. And this was sort of an opportunistic comparison test. We had a updated Ford Everest Titanium top of the range model in, and it was actually Wongy who said to me, hey, why don't I get a Prado and we can do a twin test? And that's a great idea. And so we got a Prado back that we'd already reviewed, that Paul had already done a video on. It was the Prado Kakadu. And the story is basically these are the two top of the range seven-seat diesel hardcore 4x4s in their respective ranges. The Prado is obviously the most popular in its class. Every single month, it's one of the top-selling vehicles in the country, but the Everest is growing at a rate of knots. The Everest being, of course, the Ford Ranger-based SUV designed and developed right here in Australia for the world. So let's start with pricing. The Titanium Everest kicks off at 73 grand on the road, which equates to a driveway price of 80, but at the moment it's doing a special campaign price of just under 73 grand driveway. Now, it actually lines up best with the Prado VX, which is one specification rung below the top of the range, which is about 83 grand on the road. But due to availability of press fleet, we had the Kakadu instead, which is 95 grand. So as tested, the Prado is actually about 20 grand more than the Everest Titanium, which does sort of put into context that Toyota does charge a premium for its products. And contrary to a lot of people's opinions, the Prado is actually not a bigger vehicle than the Everest. They are almost identical in terms of dimensions. People think that the Prado is this bigger beast that sits above it, but it's not a Land Cruiser, it's a Prado, and it is the same size as the Everest. In terms of features, they both have things like sunroof, privacy glass, LED headlights, leather-accented seats with heating, you know, proximity key access, big touchscreens, climate control, sat-nav. I mean, these things are loaded to the gills. The Everest has got 20-inch wheels and a powered tailgate, which the Prado doesn't have as tested, but the Prado does counter with ventilated seats, heated rear seats, an extra zone of climate control, four more speakers, a refrigerated center console, which is great for storing that six-pack on a camping trip, and a 360-degree camera. So there is no doubt that the Kakadu might be more expensive, but it also comes better equipped. And if you do step down into that Prado VX, and I've been very careful to sort of lay this out in the story, the Prado VX is very, very little more expensive than the Everest and comes similarly equipped as well. So the decision around these vehicles really isn't down to specifications. Moving on to drivetrains, again, super, super similar. So the Ford's 2-litre bi-turbo engine makes 157 kilowatts of power and 500 newton metres of torque. 2 litres sounds real small, but it is a sequential bi-turbo setup and it does have pretty damn good outputs. Very narrow peak torque band of only 1750 to 2000 RPM, but that is somewhat countered by the 10-speed automatic transmission, which has very closely stacked ratios to keep the engine in its happy spot. Can tow 3.1 tonnes, uses a claimed 7 litres every 100 k's on the combined cycle. Now, the Prado recently had an update. Its 2.8-litre turbo diesel is the same as the one used in the Hilux, 150 kilowatt, 500 newton metres, but that peak torque is available across a much wider part of the rev band than the Ford. It does only use a 6-speed auto, though, and it has a slightly lower towing capacity of 3,000 kilograms. Both are permanent full-time 4x4 with low range and locking rear diffs. One key advantage is that, as tested, the Prado only had an 87-litre fuel tank, which is a smidgen bigger than the Ford's. But if you opt to have the spare wheel move from under the floor to onto the back of the tailgate, you get an extra fuel tank, which gives you 150 litres of fuel storage, which gives you about 1,900 kilometres of theoretical driving range. So if you are a grey nomad going out into the wilds of nowhere, the Prado really does kind of come into its own. Underneath, double wishbones at the front, multi-link at the rear, but the Prado Kakadu has air suspension at the rear, which is a big advantage over that Everest. In terms of ground clearance and 4x4 tech, they're very similar, although the Kakadu does come with a crawl mode where you can adjust the speed at which the car crawls over obstacles in low range, and it also has that suspension that you can change the height of at the rear. So it does have a few more gadgets to play with when you're off-road, but look, very, very similar vehicles on paper with the exception of price. Having driven them, well, they kind of do different things well. So the Everest has possibly the best ride of any vehicle on sale. They did the suspension tuning in Australia and it shows. It just eats up corrugated, nasty, ungraded gravel and expansion joints and potholes and all the things that you throw at a car. It just eats them up like you wouldn't believe. You barely feel it. It's like a Bentley the way that it soaks up bumps. It's quieter than the Prado. I did decibel tests of both. It's a bit quicker than the Prado. So that little two-liter engine might look weedy, but it's actually a little quicker, albeit still over 10 seconds to get to 100. So neither of these are exactly rocket ships. I've towed a 2.5-ton caravan up Mount Ousley. Didn't love it, but didn't hate it. In its defense, nothing this side of a V8 Land Cruiser is going to find an easy time doing that. So, you know, it can handle it. Longer service intervals as well. So that's a massive bonus. The Prado feels bigger inside. The back seats have more space. The windows are larger. The interior is miles ahead of the Everest's. The Everest's is a plasticky, Ranger-like, pretty downmarket cabin, to be honest with you, whereas the Prado has a more premium, substantive feel to it. It's got that longer tank, as mentioned. Its engine feels a bit more relaxed because it's got more of its peak torque available more often. And obviously, you've got Toyota's peerless rural dealership network and its unbelievable resale value that means that price gap will narrow when it comes time to sell out the other side. So incredibly hard to split these two. I think against our metrics, the Everest probably just edges it because of the price advantage. I would personally drive back in the Prado because I think it's still, despite being long in the tooth, my preferred vehicle. But these are probably two of the best diesel hardcore 4x4 tow cars that you could really get this side of 100 grand.
How did you find the fuel economy?
Yeah, so neither of them quite lived up to their claims. So the fuel use in the Prado was 10.6 litres every 100 Ks, and the fuel use in the Everest was 8.9. So there's quite a differential there. And that's, I guess that's kind of to be expected because the Ford's drivetrain has been developed ostensibly for fuel consumption. But then when you start towing, it does change a bit. The Ford does spike a little more than the Prado does, and that gap does narrow if you're towing a caravan around. So again, it really does depend on how you're driving them. But you could basically be sure that the Everest is going to be a little bit better on fuel.
If you'd like to read up in more in detail of that very timely comparison, head to carexpert.com.au. It is live now. That is just about a wrap for this week's podcast. Hey, we've got some interesting comparisons coming up soon, Moko.
We certainly do. I've recently been driving three electric cars, the Nissan Leaf E-Plus extended range, the Kona Electric from Hyundai, and the just-launched Kia Niro, which is essentially a platform twin of the Hyundai. All of them are about 60 to 65 grand, and none of them are as good as a Tesla Model 3 base model, which costs the same money. So this is actually a comparison to determine what is the second best $60,000-ish EV money can buy.
I love that.
Which, it's honestly, I drove them and I was like, these are pretty good cars, but I can't help but think that you know, base Tesla Model 3 now being 63 grand list is sort of a no-brainer if that's the kind of money you want to spend on an EV. And then Wongi, we've also had you doing a comparison this week. Why don't you tell us about that, mate?
Yeah, so we got through the Ford Focus Active and the Mazda CX-30 G20 Evolve. So I feel like the Focus is really underappreciated. Not a lot of people know about the Active. So it's sort of like a Subaru XV version of the Focus without all-wheel drive. And before people say, like, oh, no all-wheel drive, why would you bother with that? When you think about how many of those small crossovers are sold with front-wheel drive, including the CX-30 that we've got actually, it makes a lot of sense because it's more powerful than just about anything else in the segment. Because it's based on a Focus, it'll drive better than anything else, including Luma. So it's sort of like an interesting, you know, twin test between, you know, a fan favorite, which is, you know, anything Mazda is going to sell well. It resonates with buyers. They've got attractive design, nice cabins, all of that stuff. But I think that the Focus Active really deserves to be on people's consideration list because it offers pretty much everything that most people want out of a small crossover, but just no one knows what it is. So I'm really keen to really flesh out this one. I've been driving them back to back the last few days and I feel like it's quite a close contest and maybe closer than I might have thought. So we'll just have to wait and see, and I'll probably talk about it in more depth in a couple of weeks' time.
Absolutely. Don't tell us who won yet.
This really made me, on a quick side note, realize, and look, no offense to Ford, I think Ford's a terrific company, but it made me like kind of recognize just how bad Ford is at selling vehicles that aren't either the Ranger or the Mustang. Because the Focus and Focus Active are brilliant, and yet the Focus Active sales are not even, what, a tenth of what the CX-30 does? They're so similar in the way that they're conceptually, they look similar, they're the same size, very similar outputs, features, you name it. And yet Everybody knows the Mazda, and so few people know the Ford, and that's a disservice to them. But Ford really doesn't do well at selling non-Ranger type vehicles, does it?
Yeah, it's a real shame. And without going on for too long about it, I really have to, you know, I really drive home to a lot of people that ever ask me about Ford product that in Europe, where the focus is made, because the we get focus is out of Germany. So it's a German vehicle. And over in Europe, they are considered as a direct rival and held to the same regard as like the Golf. It's, you know, it's sort of like a mainstream hatch shootout, similar to how the C-Class and the 3 Series are. Normally, the Ford product is more sporty and very engaging, so very BMW-like in its execution. And then, you know, you've got your Volkswagens, which are a bit more all-round and more luxury-focused, that are probably similar to like a Mercedes or Audi by comparison. And so over there, you know, everyone has a Mondeo. I have family in Spain that love their Mondeos because they actually have a factory there. So the Escape that we get comes from the Valencia plant out there, and the Mondeo used to come from out of Spain as well. So over in Europe, they're huge because they make them there, they develop them there, design them there, all that kind of stuff. Whereas here, they're just not appreciated. It's a real shame because Australia's actually interesting in that we have really European tastes in cars, but we don't seem to buy the same European cars that the Europeans do. We're starting to see that change with things like Skoda. But yeah, like the European Ford product, I have always said that European Ford product is actually, you know, fundamentally excellent. Like they drive beautifully, they're well made, they've got great tech, but just no one buys them. So it's really a shame that, you know, it takes comparisons like this to get people to even know what's on sale, because it's a really good car. So I'm really excited to really flesh out this comparison and hopefully give people some insight into what something they haven't considered.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll talk in depth, I'm sure, in the very near future. Oh, okay, wrapping up, Moco, what sort of cars we got through the garage next week?
Well, we've obviously had to do a few shuffles lately because of this one-week lockdown. So clearly there's going to be a few changes. But as it stands, we've got the plug-in hybrid Kia Niro, newly launched, and the MG HS plug-in hybrid as well. A revisit of the Ford Fiesta ST, which we just haven't driven it in a while, and sometimes it's nice to have a revisit before a car goes off the press fleet. New generation Hyundai Tucson Highlander is coming through, as is a new generation Toyota Kluger Hybrid. So both of those cars are massively important newly launched vehicles, and we're very curious to see how they go. And there's also a comparison that I'll be working on featuring the Passat 162 All-Track and the Subaru Outback all-wheel drive touring, which line up pretty well against one another. So some really interesting, exciting new metal coming through the garage.
Good stuff. What's the car expert team getting up to next week, J-Wo?
So we've actually got quite a few launches next week, and unfortunately because of our lockdown, the Melbourne guys are going to have to stay at home while everyone else has some fun. So Tony Crawford's going to be driving the Ford Mustang Mach-1 at City Motorsport Park in Sydney, which I think he is perfectly placed to do that because he owns a Mustang Bullitt himself, which I was very fortunate to ride shot in when I was in Sydney last week. He took me out to dinner in it and I felt like an absolute superstar.
The downside, of course, Wong, is that you had to put up with Crawford's driving, which, you know, nobody deserves that.
Oh, well, look, we got everywhere very quickly.
I'm testing to see if he's listening to this one, because he'll send me a very angry text if he is. So this will be a really good acid test to see if he's listening.
Yeah, good idea. And then Alborz is going to be very busy next week filling in for some of us. So he's going to be doing the Toyota Kluger launch out of Sydney, which is, as Moco just said about the Kluger that we've got coming through the garage, it's one of the most important launches for Toyota in a long time. The Kluger's a top seller. It's been needing an update file, and we've been itching to get behind the wheel of this new generation car because it's been out in the States for like a year and a half.
And it's got a hybrid now, finally.
Exactly right. It's the first hybrid version in Australia. So I reckon if the RAV4 and the Camry, anything to go by, we're going to be seeing a lot of these on the road. And finally, Alborz will jump from Toyota into Genesis and will be test driving the brand, well, not brand, but the facelifted G70 sedan out of Sydney. So, you know, as a refresher, basically a Kia Stinger underneath, but much nicer inside. And they're really going for Mercedes and BMW with this one. So it'll be interesting to see what he thinks of that.
Good stuff. All right. Well, enjoy the lockdown, gentlemen. And we'll see each other and speak to each other next week.
I'm going to stock up on toilet paper and beer so that I'm covered on both bases. And I've got my little screen here at home that I can work off, and you know, yep, we're all good to go.
We're all set.
I'm ready for a lot of Mario Kart battles with my siblings for the next 7 days.
That sounds like fun. Mike Costello and James Wong, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thank you, Mandy.